I think the key to being a great HR leader is to really be the one who is not defending just the tribe, but defending the organization.
Welcome to We're Only Human, a podcast focused on blending research and practical advice to help today's HR, talent, and learning leaders improve business outcomes. Let's welcome your host, Ben Eubanks.
Hey everybody, this is Ben Eubanks, host of We're Only Human, and so glad to have you here today. Today I am really pumped to have a conversation. I was just telling them before we started that I love being able to do the podcast because it's a great opportunity to talk to people that are passionate about their work, that are excited about doing new and different things in the world of HR. And you know, we talked to really cool vendors here, we talked to really cool practitioners here, and just hearing about the different stories, it helps all of us, I think, because we all want to know, hey, I'm not the crazy one. Sometimes it's easy to feel like that. You know, if you're in a small organization or if you're in a bigger one, it's easy to feel kind of stuck sometimes. And you want to hear someone else that's been there, that's had some success. And so today we're going to hear one of those fun stories from someone, again, that loves what he does, loves his profession. I won't put too many words in his mouth before I bring him on. But today we're going to have a conversation with Michael Stambaugh. He is the Chief Human Resource Officer at, get a breath here, the Henry M. Jackson Foundation for the Advancement of Military Medicine. We're going to say HJF from here on out because it's the longest title of an organization ever known to man. But Michael is a sharp professional. I actually got to speak to his team a few weeks ago, and it was so much fun. And he agreed to come on, share some of his insights with us. So, Michael, welcome to the show.
Hi, Ben. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Really appreciate you giving me the time to speak to the audience and your listeners and share some of the experiences I've had here more recently and across my career. I think you got one of the greatest jobs there is out there. And I hope one day I can strive to be able to do the same myself. So pleasure to be here.
Awesome. Very cool. So I gave him your title. I gave him your organization, but I'm going to bet that 99% of people have no idea who HJF is, right? So tell us a little more about what you do day-to-day, what the organization does as a whole, so they can wrap their minds around that as we're telling some of the story today.
Yeah, absolutely. Henry M. Jackson Foundation, HJF, is actually a nonprofit organization that was congressionally established in 1983 to carry out the advancement of military medicine and to help the warfighters and the needs for military medicine on the battlefield and here at home. So much of it is congressionally funded funds that come through the organization. And what we are really is just a group of people who've really come together and operate towards a mission-driven purpose. While we don't have a majority of the staff being prior military, they do have a connection to that military lifestyle and family, and they either have family members that have been military or friends and family have been military, and it's just a collection of people that have come together, really, really intelligent, helping the military with their need, and so it's a really mission-driven organization that everybody's really proud to be with, and many of which are very long-term employees. We have employees that have been with the foundation since its inception. We have employees that have been with the foundation 10, 20, 25 years, and they've really dedicated their lives to helping the service men and women out there that need our support as civilians, and they get to contribute in that way. So that's really, in a nutshell, what HJF is. I myself have come to the foundation a couple of months ago, in less than a year, about 11 months I've been here, and we are, I'm really proud to be here. I had spent much of my career in human resources over the last 19 years doing international and global human resources across the world. I spent 15 years of that deployed as a practitioner of human resources, and then repatriated myself about 5 or 6 years ago to come back to the U.S. and start supporting organizations internationally. So my background has been primarily in global human resources, and I've been able to take that experience and bring it here to the U.S. and work with a few other humanitarian and nonprofit organizations that are mission-driven to really help them advance their human resources and human capital needs to really help unencumber the real true stars of the organizations who are carrying out the programs and the science and the research that's needed to be done. So that's kind of me in a nutshell. Like I said, just coming up on a year, and so I think we're going to talk about some of my experiences in that first 11 months and challenges, and maybe pass along a couple lessons learned to others.
Yeah, absolutely. So I was thinking, you're telling the story, you're giving the background of the organization, and most people don't think, when they hear nonprofit, they don't think forward-thinking HR, right? It just doesn't scream that usually. You know, we expect that in some cool tech firm or something else. But I think that, again, your variety of experience in a variety of industries has allowed you to come in and bring this different flavor, maybe this different kind of approach to it. And so I'd love for you to talk with us about, why was there a need for HR transformation there a little bit? You know, maybe kind of set the stage for us. And then I would love for you to walk through a little bit of, you know, what this last year's been like for you. You're living, you're breathing this every single day. And when we hear about transformation, usually from an HR perspective, it seems like this vague thing that's hard to wrap your arms around. It seems kind of fuzzy, and people talk about it in these kind of generalities. But again, this is the thing that you and your team have been living and breathing. And so I'd love for you to talk about, you know, what led to that? That's the world's longest lead-in for a question, basically. But what led to this? And then talk about kind of what it's been like for you for the last year.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I'll start off by talking about sort of industry practices. A majority of my career was for a for-profit organization with stakeholders and regulatory affairs that they had to watch very closely. And so in those environments, human resources is very different, what I've learned, than in a nonprofit or a mission-driven organization. So I've operated in both. And I will say that in the latter, the mission-driven and nonprofit sectors, sometimes even in the humanitarian sector, the human resources, the approach to human resources is what I would call HR light. It is not as robust and formalized as you see in a for-profit. So as I've come into these organizations in the nonprofit and humanitarian space, transformation has always been something that's been carried out. And when we talk about transformation, it's not always the same thing for everyone. But transformation for organizations who are trying to strive or aspirationally reach a certain level of operating capabilities is very different. And we can't really talk about transformation without talking about all of the different changes that are happening so rapidly in legislation, in globalization, in economies, external environmental conditions. So it's transformation is for different reasons, different things for different organizations. But my experience has been that in the for-profit sector, where there's more resources generally available, there's more alignment with compliance with all of those ever-changing things around the organization. Whereas in the humanitarian nonprofit sector, there tends to be less resources because they are mission-driven. They try to dedicate as much of their funding to their program as possible. So human resources tends to not have as much investment into it, and it causes them to kind of backslide. So as things are moving away from them so quickly around laws and regulations and just the work environment and the competitiveness, it just keeps them further and further behind. The gap keeps growing. And so what I have seen on the positive side of the nonprofit sector is kind of a rebirth of investing in human resources. I think with some of the more stringent rulings that have come out recently in the courts and some of the legislation that's come out, they can no longer not invest in their human resources and human capital to be compliant. And so that's really caused a lot of organizations to say, hey, we do have to look at this. We do need to invest in it. It's not a overhead burden, because ultimately in the long run, it is costing them more money not to invest in human resources via, legal matters, advisory, or having to outsource those services. So I think when my journey here at HJF, and when we talk about transformation here, I think is very much along the lines of that nonprofit sector tempo, that just sort of a rebirth, a reinvestment, a reaffirmation that we are going to operate irreproachably, we are going to be above board, we are going to do everything compliant, and that means that we do need to invest in human resources. So I just want to talk a little bit about how we were able to kind of garner that support from our leadership, because I do have to say that 11 months in, I'm overwhelmed with the amount of support, almost to the point where I have to beat some of the support back a little bit and say, I can't fix everything right now. So we are going to only improve these certain areas now, and we'll work on those other areas later. But the way I was able to garner that support and those resources was to really go out and benchmark. Look at what there's just a ton of resources out there for organizations now to see free information that's available on the web by very reputable organizations that provide you information around where you potentially might want to be as an organization in regards to how much you're spending towards human resources as a percentage of your overall value, how many employees you should have per 100, what your time to fill is. There's a lot of metrics out there. And so when you start to articulate where you and be able to measure where you're at today versus where you aspire to be, that's a very compelling story that people can get behind. But you do have to show them at the end of the day what the return on that investment is. It isn't just to make HR happy. It isn't to make our lives easier and make it less cumbersome to process a promotion or hire an employee. You have to keep your focus and lens on helping the stakeholder, the end user. And in our case, that's our programs people. Our job is to really get them the most qualified people in the fastest means possible and really unencumber them from a lot of the burdensome administrative human resources tasks that go along with that. So I just want to circle back to your original question about transformation and you know what it's been like. I think it's been it's unique to every organization. I think transformation doesn't always have to be a rip and tear or a 180 from where you're currently at. Sometimes transformation is just a different version of yourself, and sometimes that's just an elevated version of where you're at today, almost taking it to the next level. So transformation, unless you're going through a very aggressive merger and acquisition or hostile takeover, or maybe you're in demise as an organization and you have to transform to survive, I think that's a very different type of transformation versus just trying to elevate and improve and kind of just make your services be better than what you've been able to offer in the past.
I love that. So one of the things that occurs to me here is you're talking through the part about being ROI driven and focusing on, you know, benchmarking the spend on employees, things like that, those kind of programs. I actually read a study earlier this year that said this pair of economists had gone through and looked at all of these metrics for business metrics, right? Looked at stock price, looked at, you know, risk and valuation, all these other different metrics on financial side, and they couldn't find any that correlated with long-term business performance. When they started looking at HCM metrics, they actually found one, and I do not remember the exact name of the metric because they were kind of like they were very detailed and complex, but it was basically the net HR spend per employee or something like that was predictive of whether the company succeeded long term. And I love how that kind of ties into the conversation you're saying here, because those organizations didn't know that when they're spending on their people that that's going to lead them to be successful. But that's the story that you found, right? Mm-hmm. Career and now at HGF, you're seeing like let's get out of the way. We hired really great people. We hired smart people. Why are we going to try to stand in their way and make all these policies and stuff and try to drag them down when they came here to do a great job? You know, humanitarian nonprofit sector, they're usually mission oriented. Like they come here, they want to do this work. They are excited to do this work. Let's try to make sure that our processes and our approaches are as streamlined as possible, so we're not hampering them and getting in the way of them actually doing the thing that they came here to do. Right?
Yeah, exactly.
Goodness. Okay, so I love that. I love the story, and I love the example, some of the things there. I actually wrote down, like, unencumbering the people. I love that phrase because it's about stay out of their way and let them do great things. That very different approach to HR than that of, again, of kind of the old days of HR's got to have their hands in everything, got to be in the way of everything, got to monitor every decision, everything else. So, okay. Let's shift gears just a little bit, because part of this transformation for you and for your team and for your organization has been about the technology, the tools that you've been using. And we don't have to name any vendors if you don't want to, but I know you just went through a buying cycle, and I'm curious about the process that you went through internally, how you built the business case, right? Because a lot of people, I would imagine, are hearing this and thinking, Michael's been there for, he's coming up on a year. They've already gone through a buying cycle for technology. That seems very accelerated, and most of them can't imagine doing that fast if they've already got the credibility, they've already got the clout, they've already got the support internally. They still can't imagine doing it that quickly. So I'm curious, I was really shocked to hear your story, and would love for you to talk about a little bit of that part of it, you know, building the business case for it, and how you approach that.
Yeah, that's a very astute observation, and I'm glad you brought it up, because it is not customary really, we made that decision within the first 6 months of me being here, and we've gone through that buying cycle. So yes, we are moving to a new HRIS system. It is very aggressive, and I don't recommend it for everyone. But what I do recommend is that if you're in a large enough organization, and you have enough resources internally, and you have individuals at the decision-making level who are experienced enough to make those assessments, by all means, do it. And that's what we had here. We had a team of 20-plus very bright, intelligent, experienced individuals that I was able to bring together, and myself included, having gone through implementations of other HRIS systems, to know which questions to ask and know what to look for in a very succinct and rapid way. Again, I don't recommend that for everyone, because it doesn't fit everybody's work model or workplace. I've been, you know, if you're a smaller organization and you don't have those internal resources, and you maybe don't, maybe you only have a director of HR who's never implemented before, it is advisable to bring in outside counsel and to bring in external consultants. And that's when the timeline starts to get really stretched out and can become a bit more costly, but it's definitely an investment worth doing, because the timeline will stretch out because they don't know your business yet, and they have to learn all of your interworkings. They need to work your workflows, how you want the organization to go and operate. And so that takes them time to learn. And then they have to go and scan the market of what all the new systems are doing and what new technologies out there, and then come back to you and find out what exactly, what appetite do you have for these new technologies, and what can you afford and not afford. Those are all decisions that need to be made. I think the reason our process was much quicker was because I had a very clear vision of what we needed to achieve. I saw where we were with our current system, and I've been keeping pace with what the new systems and the technology that's out there can do and will do, and the functionality of it. And so I already had a lot of that knowledge in place. So I already had a vision of what's out there already, could very quickly determine, you know, what pieces we could add to the organization, which would improve kind of pain point areas and really help us unencumber the staff and the workforce so that they can do their work. And once we found, you know, the tools, the new HRIS systems that could do those things, we started to talk with them and we had dialogues. But I think the important thing was to ensure that everybody coming along the journey got the same knowledge that I already had attained over the past years of implementing HRIS systems. And so it was, I think one lesson learned that I had was to make sure that everybody does absorb that knowledge and gets to go along that journey very quickly, whereas I spent many years on that journey learning little pieces of information along the way. So I think the hardest piece of doing a rapid systems buy cycle is to, you know, really just make sure that you're flooding them with information and also proving that it can work. You know, we talk about change management. I'm sure a lot of your listeners are aware about the change management process, and you have to there's nothing new out of what I'm getting ready to say. It is very much that process, but you really have to explain to them why they do need to change and the risk of not changing, and convince them that there really is a problem, because that's the first hurdle, is to let people even adopt the idea that there really is a problem to even fix. Because I didn't do that early on, and I did have some resistance that said, well, why aren't we just staying with our new system and just investing in it? But I had already made the assessment, and we had done the analysis that even doing that wasn't going to be enough for where we wanted to go to. So definitely making sure that people know why the change needs to happen, convince them that there's something better out there than what you currently have, that even though you're going to spend a little more money, it's a good return on the investment because of all of the benefits you're going to get out of a new system and the new technology that's out there are all very important. But I will caveat, even after you do all of that, there's still, until it goes live, you will still have some resistance. There's some disbelievers, and I completely accept all of that through any process. And I think really all you can do is, my recommendation would be not to try to fight that resistance and go toe-to-toe and create tension around it. Just let the system come into place and let them kind of organically see the benefit of supporting it and the benefit of why you made that decision. And hopefully in the end they'll come and shake your hand and buy you a cup of coffee at the end of the process.
Awesome. I love that. So I was actually remembering, as you're talking through some of those things, we just a few episodes back, episode 52, had an interview with an implementation consultant, and he gave like the top three issues with implementation. So that's probably a good listen for you, actually, Michael.
Yeah,
for everybody else that's listening, they're like, hey, I'm with you. I've made a purchase. We're waiting to implement, or you know, we're at the beginning of a buying cycle. That one was another good conversation and fun, because he's like, I've seen everything, that every way that you can screw it up, and so I'm like you. You said you picked all these pieces up over time, and you probably stumbled a little bit here and there, but you figured it out. You have a pretty good ironed out process now, and I love the idea, though. You talked about transitioning that knowledge, those competencies, to your team, because I've never heard someone talk about it in that perspective. And that is very much a skill, right? Understanding how to buy technology. No one, I have four kids, not one of them understands how to buy technology. No one is born with that knowledge. You have to see it. You have to experience it, go through it. And most people just do it as a way to, I've been in organizations where they kind of shield the rest of the team from it. Like, oh, I'm the champion for this initiative, so I'll just take all the effort and all the communication and all the, you know, everything on. But then everybody else is kind of left in the dark, waiting, like, oh, you know, suddenly we're going to roll out next week, or, you know, whatever else it happens to be. And they miss out on that chance to be a part of the process, see how the decisions are made, see how to even build that business case, right? You're talking about seeing the value, the return on the investment, and everything else, helping your team understand those things. I have to imagine that makes it easier, not just to sell it inside the business, but also to get the people on your team on board with this. Some will still pushback, right? That is inevitable. Again, change management wouldn't be a thing if everybody always believed everything the first time they heard it. But I have to imagine that made it easier for you in the big picture, because you are an open book about this. You're not trying to, you know, I'm getting all the credit, I'm getting all the glory, so I'm going to keep all this to myself, and then, you know, I'll get the rewards when this is done with. No, this is our team, this is our initiative, and, you know, I'm leading it, but this is us making this happen. So I love that approach, and really being intentional about that, again, is something that I think everybody should make that note right now, if they're not driving when they're listening to this. Make a note of that right now, because I think that's an important piece. So let's get one last bit of practical advice. I'm going to squeeze you, right?
Sure.
I've been grilling you for a little bit. I'm going to squeeze you for one last bit of practical advice. If you have anything else to share, other HR leaders that are listening to this, recruiting, talent leaders, people that are trying to impact the business in a positive way, just like you have. Right, I've been in your office. I've seen your team. They respect you. They appreciate the leadership that you're giving them on a daily basis. And so I think other people can have something else to learn from you. Any other ideas, suggestions, tips you picked up, whether at HJF or through your experiences, that you'd like to share with someone else, is like, hey, this is the killer tip to being a great HR leader. I'd love to hear it.
Yeah, I think the key to being a great HR leader is to, for an organization, is to really be the one who is not defending just the tribe, but defending the organization. As an executive leader, you're always going to make decisions that are going to upset someone. As an HR leader, you're going to make decisions that are going to upset your own team. But you can't negotiate at the senior executive level just trying to keep your team happy. And that sounds hard to hear, but what I've learned is that in the long run, as you communicate out that to your staff what your role is in the organization, they will respect the decisions you make even though they don't like them. Because when they understand that your decisions are being made not because you were too weak to stand up against another executive or stand your ground on a certain particular situation that affects them individually, and that it's for the greater good of the organization, share that with them. Let them know that we cannot do this certain thing because if we do it that way, we're not going to be competitive as an organization. And when employees hear that, even though they don't like the decision, I think they respect the decision. And when they respect the decisions that you're making at a very sophisticated level like that, they will respect you as a leader. So that would be my advice, is don't hide things from your employees. Don't let them feel like you are trying to, only defend them, but also defend them when they need to be defended. And be clear with them about why you're making decisions that negatively impact them. And when they find that out, they'll understand it is for the greater good, and they'll respect that. So that'd be my advice.
Awesome. I love that. That's one of the things that I saw very early on in my career. The leader that I had, I've seen the negative side of it too. One of the HR leaders I had, though, I got to see her. She gained that credibility with the rest of the organization because she focused on the things that they cared about, right? Regardless of where they were, who they were, she focused on the things that they cared about. And so when it came time to, for lack of a better term, kind of cash in, like, we've got to take something bad's happening, and so here's the news I've got to deliver to you, bad news from the HR perspective. Those people said, wow, that sucks, but I trust you because you've taken this time to actually build this relationship with me. You've actually, taken the time to invest in this connection with me as a person versus just always being, the HR police bringing bad news and never taking time to leave your office or to build a network within the organization of people that actually like to see you coming, that want to have a conversation with you, that respect your advice. And, I don't know if that's the one of the things that popped in my head as you're talking through that, because it's one of those things that I always, when I saw her do that, I said, okay, this is what I've always got to do. This is just a non-negotiable for me. Every time I'm practicing HR, every time I'm leading a team, leading a department, this is the way that I've got to do it, because I've seen it the negative ways. The other ways, where they just kind of pop in, pop out, and they never take the time to build a positive relationship. So, goodness. All right. So, someone wants to connect with you, wants to learn more, wants to understand more about HJF, what's the best way to do that?
Yeah, if they're interested to learn more about our organization, they can definitely go to many of the sites and social media out there. We have hjf.org. We have a Twitter page. We have a Facebook page. We have an HJF LinkedIn page. If anybody wants to reach out to me and connect individually, I'm happy to connect with folks through LinkedIn. It's just Michael Stambaugh, Stambaugh, on LinkedIn. And we'd love to hear from you and learn. I'd really be excited for people to learn about all the great work we're doing to advance military medicine, which much of it actually translates over into the civilian sector. So come check out our website and see what we do.
Awesome. Michael, I appreciate you so much for taking the time today. I have told everybody before, I'm making notes over here furiously as you're talking, because I'm loving the stories you're telling, loving the examples you're giving, and this is really helpful for me, and I can only imagine how helpful it is for everybody else that's out there, practicing HR on a daily basis in the trenches. And so thank you so much for taking time out of your day to join us.
No, thank you, Ben, and I'm going to go look up that recording 52 right after this.
Awesome. I'll make sure that gets in the show notes too, along with a link to HJF and the rest of the resources there, so everyone can check that out, connect with you on LinkedIn. To everybody else, Thank you for joining us today on the podcast. I'm Ben Eubanks, your host, and we'll catch you next time.
Thank you for listening to We're Only Human. Please take a moment to share this episode with another HR leader who might see it as a valuable resource in their daily work. For more information about the podcast and to see all our show archives, please visit upstarthr.com.